Welcome to A Cult of Personality at acultofpersonality.net. Thank you for listening.
Welcome to A Cult of Personality, esoteric podcast extraordinaire. Peering behind the veil to provide you with recorded interviews with esoteric teachers and scholars from all over the world. You can find us online at occultofpersonality.net, which features an extensive archive of recordings. Just click the available shows link on the website. I'm your host, Greg Kaminsky. Welcome back. This is podcast episode 127, featuring an interview with Julian Vane and Nikki Weird, primarily about the Book of Baphomet, which they co-authored. A Cult of Personality podcast is made possible by you, the listeners, and the subscribers to the A Cult of Personality membership section. Your support allows for the continuation of free recorded podcasts and the publicly available archive. If you're not already a subscriber to the membership section, please take a moment to click the link on the sidebar of the occultofpersonality.net website or browse to occultofpersonality.net/membership. Just peruse the amount and quality of the available content. Access to everything costs only $7.95 per month, and there's no obligation. It's a great way to support independent media. And now, 3, 6, and 12-month prepaid subscriptions are an option as well, making subscribing to the membership section even more convenient. You can also support the show and sponsor an episode by donating via the PayPal donate button on the website, as Steve M. and Diane W. did in order to sponsor this episode. Thanks again, Steve and Diane. Now, in episode number 127, we're joined by Julian Vane and Nikki Weird, co-authors of The Book of Baphomet, recently published by Mandrake of Oxford. You can find Julian and Nikki's website at theblogofbaphomet.com. That's four words, no spaces, theblogofbaphomet.com. I would also commend to your attention Vane and Weird's excellent article entitled Baphomet Unveiled, which is freely available in the Occult of Personality membership section, and a link to it is in the show notes. Here's some brief background information about our guests. Julian Vane has been involved with the magical world for over 20 years. He has published numerous articles, led a variety of esoteric workshops and courses, and is a prominent figure in contemporary British occultism. His other published titles include Magic Works, Now That's What I Call Chaos Magic, and Pharmacon. And for more than two decades, Nikki Weird has been intensely involved in group magical practices. A member of the Illuminates of Thanateros, she is currently head of the British Isles section, an organizer of occult conferences, and vice-chancellor of Arcanorium College. The Book of Baphomet is Nikki's first published book. And last but not least, I'd like to share a few words with you regarding the main subject of our conversation and the Book of Baphomet by Nikki Weird and Julian Vane. Baphomet, then, is to be the tiny eight-letter moat around which a mythic pearl of great price has grown. Like Levi's hybrid devil god, this deity demonstrates what we now know, that the natural world and humanity are of the same stuff. The caduceus coiling of snakes rising from its groin is the DNA common to all life. The humanoid form reminds us our species is embedded in the world, not the result of some special act of ex nihilo creation by a transcendent God. Baphomet invites us to see no division between mundane and magical, between male and female, between animal and human. It invites us to use our intelligence and the certain knowledge that we are an integral part of the story of evolution, rather than the result of some fall from grace, and form new relationships with the other people and species that exist on Earth. This God is a deity of this Earth, the here and now, and if that makes it a devil for some, then so be it. Baphomet invites us to become illuminated in and through the body, to find the divine in nature, and not put off sorting out our own spirituality or ecological situation by waiting for a hypothesized apocalypse or rapture or post-mortem heaven. Baphomet is emblematic of the blurring of boundaries and the sense of interconnectedness.
Julian Vane and Nikki Weird, I want to welcome you both to the show. It's an absolute pleasure to speak with you. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you. It's our honor.
Yes, we're very, very pleased to be here with you. Thank you very much, Greg.
Oh, you're most welcome. And I want to say thank you again for the wonderful piece Baphomet Unveiled that's posted in the Occult of Personality membership section, but is publicly available for everyone. And it's received quite a lot of positive feedback, I must say.
That's really good to know. It was a lovely series of questions that you posed, and it was good to be able to take a lot of the material that the article is formed from, directly from the text itself, from the Book of Baphomet.
Yeah, I think you did a brilliant job again. So very much appreciate it. So before we talk a lot more about the Book of Baphomet, I'd like to just ask you briefly about yourselves, Julian and Nikki. Maybe you could tell us just a little bit about your sort of a brief bio and a little bit about how you became interested in the esoteric.
That's a difficult question, because I've always been interested in the esoteric from a sort of how the world works perspective. So even as a child, I can remember trying to do divinations from throwing beads on my bed cover and sort of seeing what patterns they made after I'd heard about tea leaf reading. My formal interest in the occult probably begins when I was into role-playing games and went to the game shop and bought myself a tarot deck when I was 19. A couple of years after that, after doing some more reading and sort of from a sociological kind of perspective on why do people believe things, I came across the IOT, the Illuminates of Thanatieros, or maybe it came across me, whichever way around that works. And so for the last 23 years or so, I've been a member of that. So that's my sort of occult history summed up in a nutshell.
Thank you. Julian?
I've been interested in magic for as long as I can remember, and spent my early teens doing my own experiments with yoga and meditation, and got into the work of Aleister Crowley, and then became involved with a Wiccan coven just before I was 16. Ended up working in a coven situation, doing kind of using the basic Wiccan framework, but developing a kind of a sort of eclectic magical system within that. So I kind of worked within that for a long time. I've had the opportunity over the years of working with several different groups, druid groups, native shamans in various kind of different contexts, and been involved with the Illuminates of Thanatieros for, I think, the last 10 years, something of that order.
It's fascinating. Since it seems to be a common commonality, could you talk just briefly about the Illuminates of Thanatieros?
Oh, I don't know if we're allowed to. It's a bit of an bit of a secret organisation.
Yes, only known to people who are either members or have access to the internet.
I'm not quite sure what you want us to say about it.
Maybe just a little bit about the history and the sort of the magical current behind it. Nothing too extensive. I'm just for people who aren't aware or aren't familiar.
Okay, so it's a group that was started back in the 70s by Peter J. Carroll, and it's a group that works with a paradigm which we call chaos magic. And basically it means the idea that you can choose to believe things that are useful to you at a particular moment, whether they're useful on a mundane level or a magical level. And so sometimes you'll decide to believe something just for a very short time, maybe for one ritual. But other times you might go into a belief system, like studying the runes, for example, and then you might stay with it for 10, 20, 10, 12, however many years you decide to work with it. But the idea is that you work with a system and don't necessarily, how would I phrase this? You don't necessarily stick with it forever. So it's about the arbitrary nature of belief and how any model that you choose will always be improved upon in the future.
And what it looks like on the ground is a community of people existing in many nations of the world who choose to be individual magical practitioners and come together as a community to exchange techniques and skills. And so what a meeting looks like is it's a laboratory environment where people are bringing things that they've been studying, which may be from a selection of very different belief systems. And because you have a skilled group of magicians who are gathering and a group of magicians who are very able and willing to enter different belief systems and interact with those, people have the opportunity to learn from a wide variety of very experienced practitioners. So it's a community of people who get together to exchange their skills, essentially. All of those individuals are working magicians doing their own solitary practice or practice within individual groups, either within the IoT or elsewhere. And we're a laboratory environment. That's a lot of, about what the IoT is.
And just to clarify, is there any kind of hierarchy in leadership or membership, or maybe not?
Well, of course, we can't really disclose those sorts of things, but there's a selection of sort of offices and roles within the organization. It's a fairly fairly flat system, so it doesn't have a vast number of degrees, but there are degrees which are associated with the management of that network, and there are degrees which are associated with ensuring that critique comes up to the people who have responsibility for managing the network from the grassroots. So it's quite an interesting structure which Pete Carroll and various others were involved with creating. But it's fluid. It's a fluid community. You know, how it looks now may not be how it looks in 50 or even 5 years' time. So there is a hierarchical structure, but it's primarily about ensuring that that network functions and that the laboratory environments in which people are exchanging techniques, sometimes which are quite challenging or quite kind of, intense practices, that's managed in a responsible and safe kind of way.
A lot of the leadership type of roles tend to act in a sort of, to use modern parlance, in a facilitator kind of role. So someone who's in charge of a meeting will be in charge of making sure that people know when different things are happening, that kind of leadership. So it's very much for practical reasons. There's not really any sort of pulling rank on people to say you must or must not do this.
Whoever is running a ceremony or a practice, they are the master of the temple. They're the person who is running that particular part of the show, essentially. So, you know, we're all learning from each other. It's that kind of group guru kind of concept.
You know, thank you. It's a very thorough answer. I appreciate your forthrightness about that. So I'd like to talk about the main subject, the Book of Baphomet, published by Mandrake of Oxford. And I'm curious, what is the sort of the backstory behind the book? what's your intention in writing and publishing it, and how did it come about?
Well, that's a really big question. As I mentioned earlier, it's a piece of work that's taken a very long period of time, and it's a lot of it has been about within the IoT, within the Lunar System Theros, Baphomet is one of the key pieces of iconography that tends to be returned to again and again. So although people are using different systems, it's one of those things which is basically fairly popular within that organization. And Pete Carroll was involved in sort of putting that at the very much within the early ritual systems that he was working with. And so what we wanted to do was we wanted to explore this idea. And so we did both the straightforward historical research in terms of, you know, where does the name come from, what's its connection with the Knights Templar and all that stuff. But what we also did was engage in a program of work to re-understand that particular cultural meme. And so the book is both an account of the ritual process that was involved with that, and it's also a description of what Baphomet is, at least for us. Which I suppose one might describe, you know, as it's the life force of the universe. So it's, in a sense, it's the same kind of thing that, you know, lots of different traditions speak about, but we're approaching it in our own particular way through the lens of chaos magic and the lens of the practices that are informing our own work.
One of the things that prompted the actual writing of the book was that we've been working with this deity for a long time, several years in my case, and I realised that I wanted to know more about it, because although I'd worked with it, it was sort of missing a bit of depth to it. So it was a case of focusing in on this deity and doing more exploratory kind of work into what the other implications of it might be, apart from this sort of huge, powerful force. It's like, well, but what does that actually look like?
Yeah, it's quite an interesting question. As you've described it in the article, Baphomet Unveiled. The history behind Baphomet and the name and the concept is really fascinating to me, and I know I'm not alone in this. And I'm wondering if you could comment a little bit about this idea that Baphomet sort of, I think you used the word, coalesces various concepts and in sort of energies around itself.
I mean, as a word, obviously, it appears in things like Crowley's work. We've got that fantastic image from sort of Eliphas Levi. But I think the interesting thing about it for me was twofold. Firstly, on a personal level, I'd always been really fascinated by horned gods and horned deities and that sort of iconography, probably in common with lots of people. So that was something that was in me. It was also, though, the kind of slightly whimsical chaos magic thing about, here's this word, Baphomet, which is almost certainly just a mishearing, a transliteration of Muhammad, and around this thing, which is hidden within the Templar trials and is a tiny, almost throwaway piece of Chinese whisper, this amazingly interesting deity figure set of symbols arises, which finds expression in, you know, lots and lots of different cultural domains, and becomes to some extent the, you know, the icon of the devil and all those sorts of things, but also of Pan and the reemergence of paganism within the neo-pagan tradition. So that's what a lot of it was for my part anyway.
It's fascinating. If I could ask you to sort of put on your historian caps for just a minute.
Okay.
And speculate, do you think that there is any one person or group throughout the history of Baphomet that is more responsible than any others for its perpetuation to our time today?
In the Masons, Greg. Who are you alluding to? I don't know.
Well, I think that's an open question, because I would say that Eliphas Levi is the one I would look to, who is really transmitted it from more medieval or Renaissance times to our date. But
he gives the form.
He gives the visual representation, which is then easier to understand.
And that's a lot of... Do you want to explain maybe the thing about the deity and the perceiving the deity with the shape?
Yes. So one of the things that Eliphas Levi did was to move it from a deity into being something which was a deity that represented different forms of life. So you've got the wings and you've got the scales and you've got the animal head and legs and the human body. So you've got the different and the male and female sides to it as well, which I think was something that he brought to that iconography as well. And that's very much how the IoT looks at Baphomet and how we look at Baphomet is as the living, as the deity that's the representation of all life on earth and all conscious things.
But the thing that Levi does is because it's when you have terms like the force or the great spirit or any of those sorts of things, they become perhaps for me personally and perhaps quite generally they tend towards the impersonal. Mm-hmm. Whereas what Levi does with his image of Baphomet is he draws a board around this of this horn seated winged figure. And yes, I'd absolutely agree. He's really, really pivotal in terms of the conception of this thing. He's a great visionary in that respect.
Yeah, I think it's fascinating the way his work in this area and so many others seems like it's foundational to a lot of things. And yet, I'm not sure many people really know too much about him, but I could be wrong about that.
I don't know. I mean, a lot of Levi's writing is you know, by modern tastes, a little bit turgid.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you can sort of, Crowley picks up the ball and runs with it quite happily. So you could probably get away with like reading a lot of Crowley stuff and seeing how Crowley kind of develops that idea. Levi is definitely interesting. But the whole story of Baphomet as well, for us, in terms of the historical material, is also to do with a particular perception of the world. And it's a particular perception of the world which is about things like the continuity of organic process, which, you know, Darwin identifies, in his work on evolution. And to some extent, Levi is kind of hinting at with the icon of Baphomet as this chimera that involves all of these different species, and that yet it's all one. So he's kind of driving towards the same idea, but from a kind of esoteric perspective.
Yeah, I was really interested in the way that you discussed the DNA or an evolution and even ideas like quantum physics and these things and how they all can be or also maybe all coalesce around this idea of Baphomet or this deity or God. So I think that's really interesting. I'm just wondering if you could talk a little bit more about how you reached those conclusions. I mean, reading your material, it seems really obvious, but again, I'd never read that before. So I'm just curious how you arrived at that or if it was seemed so natural.
One of the things that's important about the book is that it arose from a series of lots of conversations between us, discussing different things to do with this deity figure, how we see the world, things that we wanted to explain about it. So it was a discussion between ourselves that was the beginning of the idea of having the book, and realizing that we wanted to explore the figure of Baphomet more. So it just evolved from our natural curiosity about the world and the way that we try and link different stuff together. So a lot of the material in the book comes from different emails that we had between ourselves, phone calls, things like that. So,
I mean, I'd say in terms of the science side and the DNA kind of conceptual side of it, when we talk about life, as modern humans, we talk about things like DNA. We talk about the process whereby life evolved, and how physics gives rise to chemistry. Chemistry gives rise to life. Life gives rise to conscious awareness. And it was that sort of trajectory that we wanted to plot in the book. And the best language for doing that is the language of science, which is why the first, I don't know how many, 40 pages of the book or something, are taken up with like the story of evolution, but hopefully written in a poetic way, because this is the great myth. This is the great story of our time and our understanding of the world. And if we're going to have, you know, magic and we're going to have spooky occult stuff, then it has to plug into that iconography, because those are the myths that are alive and that power the world. And so having a magical perspective of that, on that, which is partly what, you know, the book is about, that was really important to us. It was also important because, you know, Nikki's got a background in biological science. You know, I've got a background in things like history, and to try and kind of bring those things together was a lot of what we were trying to achieve.
My science degree is actually in ecology, which encourages you to look at the world and how it works as a whole series of connected systems, right down from the chemistry within a plant cell up to landscape scale and geological time scale views of how the world works. So partly some of the sort of many perspectives of the book naturally for me occur from that kind of background.
Fascinating. Now, I don't know if it's simply the fact that you wrote this piece, Baphomet Unveiled, and I spent a good deal of time reading over it and over it and over it again and picking out all the illustrations for it, but it seems like since that time, I've noticed, I would say, an explosion of Baphomet discussion and images all over the internet. I'm on Facebook way too much, and there I can tell you it's been like nonstop Baphomet continuously. And I'm just wondering if you've noticed that too, or maybe this is just a personal thing.
We're responsible for it, my friend.
It's
all marketing. It's just marketing for the book. Yeah.
Brilliant marketing, yeah. But I'm not sure that all of these people are really keyed in on I could be wrong, you know, they all may be aware of it, and but it seems like it's bubbling up from the unconscious.
It's an idea whose time has come, I think. So we'd noticed similar sort of things starting to seep through as well while we've been writing it.
Yes, we've even sort of had that concern, oh my God, someone's going to bring out something before us, do you know what I mean? Because it was getting to the stage where I was thinking, you know, I agree, lots of material out there on the internet where previously there had been very little.
I think part of that is to do with the rising sort of ecological consciousness, for want of a better phrase, where people are starting to look at the world and the systems that we have of governance and just going, I'm not quite sure that that works terribly well. And then looking at the systems of nature and how it's worked its way through experimental organization of things.
I'd definitely like to explore that idea a little bit more in terms of people seeming to be questioning established models of governance a little bit more, because it certainly seems that way, although these models of governance haven't changed all that much. So I'm curious what has changed.
I think every group of humans always believes this, but we're a really interesting stage, and the book is Baphomet is partly about that, which is that we've got ourselves into a situation where we've used, you know, huge amounts of fossil fuel reserve, and we are able now to have, you know, conversations like we're having across the Atlantic in real time, and we have these amazing technologies. And one of the things that it's brought us to is it's brought us for the first time really as a species to the realization of the finite resources of our immediate planet, but also the possibility that, you know, we could re-engineer, we can change our social structures in quite profound ways. And at the moment, a lot of the things like the Occupy movement and various other movements that are happening are really important signs of that. But we're struggling towards answers which we'll only know to some degree in retrospect. We're rather like people in the 12th century. If you'd have asked people in the 12th century in, say, Britain, what would have come after monotheism, they'd have had absolutely no idea. They may not have even understood the question. And we're kind of like that. We know that there are other ways of organizing ourselves, ways that are better in a variety of senses. And we're struggling towards that. And I think that maybe even the upsurge in the sort of esoteric community of the iconography of Baphomet, maybe that is indicative of that same process, looking for a form, looking for a structure out of this chimeric chaos of events and situations in the world.
Yeah, and although Baphomet is a god, it's also something, or goddess even, it's something which is very imminent and present within the world around you. You don't have to believe in some strange other plane necessarily to see the presence of Baphomet. It's a deity figure which is congruent with rational scientific thinking, which I think is one of its main appeals.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think people in these times, because of the heavy reliance on science or even scientism in a way, they need a way to connect with deity that makes sense in their language, in their minds, and doesn't challenge popular opinion to such a degree that they have to somehow suspend disbelief in order to connect.
I think that there are several things there. I mean, one thing is that a lot of the mythology and a lot of the story that science allows us to look at in terms of the generation of the universe and the processes that led to life, that is itself profoundly beautiful, mm-hmm. profoundly magical, mm-hmm. profoundly inspiring.
Which is something that a lot of scientists feel as well. But because when you're writing a scientific paper, you can't put that stuff in. It still happens, but it's not recorded as part of science.
Yeah, good point. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm curious about some of the practical aspects of the book. I have not read it. But at this point, I'm looking forward to reading it. But could you talk some about the sort of practical aspects of the book? I'm not sure what that may involve, but I'm very curious.
Well, with our different sort of perspectives, with my scientific background and Julian's historian background, although we sort of have common areas of interest, those were our sort of main starting points. So we decided, well, what voice are we going to use to write the book with? And decided we were going to use lots of voices because, as well as those main sort of categories you could put us into, we also each have interests in all sorts of other things as well. So it started off that Julian was going to write the history part of it and I would write certain other bits. But then we ended up passing the pieces of writing between each other and then editing it for grammatical errors, but also adding in bits where we felt it was necessary to add different comments to each other's phrases that we'd already used. And it just gradually grew and grew. And eventually we ended up with a piece of material, which some bits of it, we're not actually sure that either of us wrote it because we can't remember who did which bits.
And so
quite fascinating.
It is. It's quite a peculiar thing to read.
You've got that sort of third mind emerging that Burroughs talks about.
Yeah.
And you have two people working together.
And in terms of the other magical work that was happening in parallel to the book, there were several things. So there were practices like we were coming up with a Baphomet invocation. So we wrote lines of poetry each, and then again intercut those and splice those. And we did ritual work together to explore that. And we also did ritual work within the context of the IoT to do exploration. That's also fed into the book. And the book contains, as is traditional with chaos magic texts, and practical material. So there's some material from Arcanorium College, which Nikki taught. Do you want to talk about that a little bit? Because that's a really kind of practical side of the text.
Just over a year ago, I did a course at Arcanorium where I'm one of the teachers, and it was a six-week-long course to do with understanding Baphomet and then ending with a Baphomet invocation. So that material is actually in the book at the end of it, so that people that read the book can decide if they want to either just sort of read through it or to actually go ahead and do the process. And it was exploring Baphomet from the different perspectives of different ways of looking at the world. So you could look at the world, for example, from the point of view of the geosphere, which is a very sort of physical type angle on the world where everything is chemistry, basically. The biosphere, which is looking at the world from a sort of the point of view of living tissue and plants, animals, things like that, that we can relate to a bit more easily. And then also looking at Baphomet from the point of view of being a person and what that means and the works that people have. And then also looking at Baphomet as an idea, as a concept, and exploring it from that angle. And then looking at it from a magical perspective is the sort of the final thing to do. And it's important to remember that these aren't like a ladder of ways of looking at it. They're more like a cluster of ideas. So they're different standpoints from around Baphomet that you can look at it from, so that you can, it's like as if you're looking at a tree, you can see it as a chemical thing or as a physical object or a beautiful thing you can write poetry about, or a thing that you can climb or whatever, but it doesn't change the actual tree at all. It's just a different way of looking at the object. So that was the point of view of the course.
And so that's a really important idea within the sort of the kind of concept of Baphomet, which is that rather than talking about hierarchical arrangements necessarily, although not necessarily, not excluding those either, you're looking at different perspectives of the world, different ways of seeing the world. And so the book talks about Baphomet from a historical perspective, and it talks about Baphomet as an idea in relation to the development of the discourse that we know as science. And it talks about Baphomet in terms of the lived-in experience of two magicians doing their magical work. So it's different views of the same thing.
Yeah, that's a very interesting point. And one of the ways it really strikes me, and when I'm asking you this, I'm not trying to make any judgment or even ask you to make any judgment, but I find it really interesting the way that Baphomet is portrayed, especially in the Devil card of the Tarot, is interpreted by people. At some level, some people see it as sort of a mask or a concealment of an idea, and other people seem to, for better or worse, see it much more literally as this sort of opposer devil figure, and that's okay with them, and they like it that way, even though these things are seemingly diametrically opposed.
I think there's several things in that. I mean, there's the idea of a kind of Gnostic rebellion implicit in some of the material on Baphomet, which is that what we have to understand is that for a very long time, Western cultures have been cultures which have been led by reliance on sacred text. And one of the interesting things about the discourse of science and indeed of magic is they're about direct experience of the world. So whether it's, of course, these things come out in the esoteric and the slightly kind of outlaw traditions of, you know, Tantra or Sufism or whatever, in lots of different cultures. But what it's about is trying to discover the world for yourself. And that, to some extent, is a rebellious position. So rather than allowing your universe to be constructed through an interpretation of a particular religious text, you go out, you discover your own spirituality, and you form that. You go out and you experiment in the world, and you understand God, you understand the book of nature, you understand Baphomet through your experimentation with the world. And so you don't have a creator who sits outside of creation. You do that what used to be called natural philosophy. You know, when the first scientists were doing their thing, they were trying to discover God through experiment and exploration, both internal and external. And that, to some extent, is, yeah, a rebellion, is a breakaway from the sort of authoritarian orders that we've had for quite a long time.
Mm. Yeah, it's almost difficult to cast one's mind back to a time when religion was much more rigid. Not impossible, certainly.
Yes.
Personally, I'm a little bit of a Kabbalah geek, if you will, so I'd like to talk about the Gematria,
yes.
Especially Crowley with his Amalantra working and the numeration that came out of that. And I'm just curious if you could talk a little bit more about that.
So 729, you want me to talk authoritatively about 729. So as you say, it, as a result of a vision, Crowley gets the spelling of Baphomet with an F and things, adds it all up, comes up with the number 729. So there's a very brief section trying not to lull the reader into sleep in the book, which does talk about the numeration. I mean, I think what's interesting with Crowley's work is the way that he sees Baphomet, because it is this dual-sexed kind of character, being the sort of, you know, the beast and the scarlet woman combined. So even in things like the position of it in the Gnostic Mass and some of the other writing, it does suggest that the Baphomet is this sort of, you know, this kind of great spirit as far as he's concerned. What other Kabbalah geek stuff would you like to talk about?
Well, I'm just, I don't know if I'm going overboard here, and I certainly don't want to put any of the listeners to sleep either, but I find it really fascinating. You have this idea of this union of opposites and the solar year and the lunar year totaling 729, and it just happens to be the cube of the number 9. I find this extraordinary, and I also find it extraordinary because, if I'm not mistaken, the letters he received were English letters, and then he went and sort of turned that into Hebrew to get the numeration. Is that right?
Yeah. So I think it's Baphometh, which he gets, or M-E-T. So he kind of does the standard sort of transliteration of taking the M for a mem, which is 40, and that kind of stuff, and adds it all up and, you know, comes up with that magic number. And of course, you know, that's quite important in terms of Crowley's understanding of the world, because that's very much the sort of the map he was working with. It's certainly one that I've used quite a lot as well.
I just am really blown away by that.
It is that union of opposites, isn't it? It is that sort of, it, you know, the numeration bears out that idea of the, you know, it's the sun and the moon combined. And it's also that, all the stuff that Crowley talks about things like Azoth and various other magic fluids, which are, you know, the first matter. And that's partly, again, connects back to this idea of Baphomet being like the life force. So it's the fact that life is implicit in chemistry. Like, that's how it works. Like, we're not, in a way, we're not that special. We just happen to be a planet, as far as we can tell, the only one upon which this has happened. But theoretically, it's in there. And it's because it's this, this on-off oscillation, this lunar and solar year in one figure.
Yeah, it's just amazing. And now, one could say I'm overly credulous that Crowley could have, you know, have known this ahead of time or worked this out consciously, or maybe it bubbled up from his unconscious, but nevertheless, it's still pretty interesting to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm also interested in this idea of the life force. Now, I would venture to say that people who are familiar with magic and just about any kind of esoteric system may have experienced at some point the feeling, or maybe even the knowing, that this force is conscious and takes direction to do things or make things happen, if you will. I'm just curious what your thoughts are about that. Maybe that's an overly simplistic interpretation. I don't know.
I suppose one way of looking at it for me is that some of that kind of life force global consciousness is a bit of an emergent phenomena of when you have lots of things happening at one time. So some of it is to do with the sort of the harmonies that you create by being in the same place at the same time with other things. In much the same way that an individual's consciousness arises from a lot of the different parts of their body as it acts.
Yeah, do you think it'd be possible to make a convincing argument that this force, this life force that we were talking about here, may even be more closely related to human individual consciousness than we realize?
What are you suggesting there, Greg? Are you suggesting that the mind is like a receiver of kind of consciousness?
Yeah, that would be one way to put it. I think the way I would put it is we have this voice in our head and we do things seemingly of our own quote-unquote free will, but how do we really, really know that? Maybe there's no way to know for sure, but...
Well, everything that happens, including our own sense of self, is the result of it's the sum of the network at that point. So in a way, I would say that although we, it is meaningful to talk about us having kind of individual selves, a lot of our self is determined by, I don't know, what we've eaten. You know, it's determined by our most recent social interactions. It's determined by our age at the given any given time. So the view of the self, I think, that we probably have and of this sort of life force is that it's this big unfolding process. Whether it has a kind of teleological plan is kind of open to question. I personally quite like the idea that the point of us is that we have to, in the words of Bill Hicks, explore inner and outer space together forever. You know, in that sort of Brian Geisen kind of sense, we're here to go. We're here to explore. That's our sort of, you know, purpose, if you will. Whether there's anything beyond that, I don't really know.
I think some of the sort of discussion we're having at the moment comes back to the way that we use different words to mean things, and that a lot of the sort of issues to do with mind, consciousness, and other words that refer to similar kind of things, a lot of the problems with that are to do with the fact that we're using language as if it refers to a real thing, whereas in fact the language is like a tool. It's like a handle on a thing that we're trying to grab hold of. We're grabbing hold of it from different directions and perspectives. But instead of trying to look at what it is, we get caught up with which handle we've got hold of, like the idea of the elephant with the blind men exploring different parts of it.
Now, I'm also curious, since you've finished writing the book, or maybe before then, what were your hopes in putting this out to the world?
The core thing that we want to do is to inspire people to look at the world around them for themselves, to see the beauty in things around them, more than that as well.
I wanted to get rich.
Yes.
Is that not an option?
That would be nice, yeah.
Bit of a disappointment. I thought publishing the obscure occult book would undoubtedly net me a vast quantity of cash.
There's the mansions and things.
Oh, yes, it's only a matter of time. Yeah. It's only a matter of time.
Yeah, we don't want to shatter that illusion, do we?
I think it's, you know, the reason for putting out, you know, any book, and certainly, I mean, I've written a lot of kind of stuff before, and I do it for lots of different reasons, and it's so that I can have fantastically interesting conversations with people on the other side of the planet, like I'm having now. You know, that's a lot of it. It's a personal doorway for me to have, you know, to enrich my world. So it always works on that respect, if not purely financially. And it's also because I want to share those ideas. I want to communicate those ideas, and obviously, hopefully, to inspire people into their own stuff. You know, so if something that I write can be, you know, scaffolding for someone else to develop their own style, then that's great. That's, you know, that's what I'd like to do.
Yeah, we both have a great passion for explaining the world to anyone that's prepared to listen. So writing a book means that we can explain it to people that aren't even there when we want to talk, is another thing.
Yeah.
Now, would you mind discussing the symbolism in the book cover illustration?
The eight-rayed star on it just appeared in my head as a sort of finished art item. I was looking at a chaos sphere that was hanging on the wall in Julian's flat, and I suddenly realised that you could join it up, because I knew that you can do an octagram where you join up the stars into like an eight-pointed star with one line. But I suddenly had this realisation that you could do it so it made a two-point upward pentagram, and also the triangle of illumination at the same time. So that's what the star in the middle comes from, and it just appeared in my head. I didn't sort of plan it or anything. It was just a vision that I had that I saw. And then that's contained within a vesica piscis shape, which is a very traditional.
So homage to the OTO.
Yes. Basically. And it's also a symbol which is a very much more feminine shape, which is something that we've tried to do with this book, is to recover the sort of the, because Elvis Levi obviously wanted Baphomet to be male and female, hence the breasts and the female arm as well. But that's something that's sort of missed a lot of coverage. Certainly Crowley didn't really go into that, which is not surprising given his not entirely flattering view of women. So So the whole sort of feminine aspect of having the vesica piscis there was important to me as well. And then if you actually look at the sort of the other parts of the thing there, the biological drawings are different kink plant, are different, they're different taxa from biology. So each one of those figures coming out from behind the vesica, each one of those is, I think it's a phylum, is the order of taxonomy. So each one of them represents something. So you've got like the spirophytes at one bit, the vertebrates are another, and there's all sorts of other things. Most of them are worms because most of life on Earth is in fact a worm in one form or another. And then if you look sort of slightly more into the background there, you can see there's a sort of like a grainy kind of picture. And that's actually, we wanted a background texture for the back of the book, or for the cover of the book, which was not entirely flat. So I suggested some, people have been asking us, well, are you going to get it printed and made up in goatskin volumes, which we decided was a tad over the top. So instead we went for skin, but it's actually a photograph of our skin. So it's a photograph of our palms. And then the texture from the skin has been used as the texture of the background there. So in effect, it's bound in human skin, which I quite liked as a little device there. And then on the back of the book, you've obviously got the DNA spiral, which is just a simplistic diagram of what it would look like if you could ever unfold it. Because in reality, DNA does not look like that. DNA just looks like a big globular mass. So, and it's very messy when you look at it. It's just coiled up like a bit of knotted string or wool, basically. So.
Kind of like life in general, I guess. Now, the marketing of the book, I have to say, is a tad bit unusual, I think. Not in a bad way, certainly. But I've enjoyed the videos and just the general approach that you've taken to this. And I wondered if you could just comment about that.
No, that's entirely Julian's fault.
I see.
He had a new toy of a video editing piece of software and wanted to use it, basically.
Basically, that's part of it. I also wanted to put out some trailers, because books generally don't have trailers. So I thought that was quite funny. We had some sort of issues over the kind of the timescale for publication and things, and so I just kind of wanted to get some stuff out, so I set up the blog of Baphomet as well and started putting material out through that, which wasn't intentionally as a leader for the book, but it's been quite a popular site and continues to be so that was kind of cool. But the trailers were I wanted to create something that didn't look like a kind of piece of kind of occulture. So I get exposed, as I'm sure you do, Greg, through Facebook, to lots of terribly dark and spooky, satanic kind of cultist, sabbatai, weirdy book stuff. And I wanted to put out something which was occult, but didn't have gyrating black magic symbols on it. And so that was the idea behind the three trailers.
And something that would appeal to the YouTube generation as well.
Indeed. If you can't say it in 5 minutes, it's not really worth saying.
No.
One of the things that I think personally is fascinating about Baphomet and this whole concept is the way that it seems to me, and I don't think I'm alone here, that this horned god idea, Pan, seems to be almost reaching through to us from antiquity and expressing itself. While there are many devotees of different deities from antiquity, Pan or Baphomet, the horned god, seems really much more persistent, in my opinion. And I'm just wondering if you could comment on that.
Yeah, definitely. If you look at the historical emergence of the horned god and you look at the emergence of Pan and all of those figures, you find that basically they happen at the time of rapid industrialization in the British Isles. So between 1800 and 1900, 1800, 20% of people in Britain live in cities. And by 1900, that percentage is reversed. So then 80% of people live in cities. And things, everything from the wind in the willows through to the work of people like Robert Graves, all of those people are trying to find a deity who represents this lost kind of Lord of the Rings style Shire, which has just been taken away from people by a combination of the acts of enclosure and industrialization. Mm-hmm. And so the power of this figure, which represents the untamed wild and represents the power of the biosphere, is really, really prevalent. And certainly the way that that's kind of come into, you know, Wicca and sort of the neo-pagan culture, it's a very, very powerful piece of iconography, very, very strong.
I find it also interesting the way you mentioned its popularity during certain time periods of industrialization and whatnot, because it does seem to be harkening back to a lost time where nature was more revered and respected. And while I certainly sense that with things like the environmental movement and people being more conscious of these things, as a whole, humanity seems to still be going in a completely opposite trajectory. And I'm just curious on your thoughts about that.
I mean, I'd say that some of that is to do with, again, something that the Book of Baphomet addresses, which is the relationship of the notions of nature and culture and how far humans are prepared to include themselves in nature. Having stood outside of it with a deity which has created us specially and that stands outside itself from the world in say, the Christian tradition or the Judeo-Christian traditions, that one of the things that we're having to understand and we're kind of grappling with as a species is realizing that we are animals. We're a very unusual and strange animal, but we are nevertheless an animal, and we are dependent on the biosphere. We're dependent on all these other structures. A lot of the kind of the ecological movement, I think, you know, we're trying to kind of see, not just to kind of romanticize a version of nature, but ourselves as included within the natural world. And that's kind of the challenge.
It's also finding our role as creatures with very strange technology compared to any other tools that other animals are using. So part of what the book looks at is, in fact, that sort of question is what are humans for? What is our unique abilities? What do we do? What do we bring to the world that is admirable, as well as looking at the things that have maybe not been quite so admirable?
Do you foresee a time that humanity may, as a whole, feel more connected with nature instead of seeing nature as something to be conquered or ruled over, where we do actually return to this balanced and respectful perspective?
In one sense, yes, absolutely, I agree. But I wouldn't use the word return. I'd use that it's more like moving forward through the period that we are or have been in and into a period where we're consciously aware of our presence as animals in the world, with different technologies, ones that are more inclusive of nature as part of the ordinary world, so that there isn't such a distinction between man-made, artificial, and natural, but blurring that boundary and even losing it altogether.
Do you believe that this progression to that state can be achieved with relative comfort, or is some sort of massive upheaval necessary in order to get there?
Well, I think some of that depends on how fast and how willingly people are able to adapt to different things. And given how quickly people have managed to change their mind, people as a group in that sense rather than as individuals, but given how quickly some cultures can change from one way of thinking to another in the historical record, I think it's quite possible. Whether that makes it likely or not is another matter, but it is possible to do it without great... Well, there'll be upheaval, but whether that's violent or one that we willingly enter into is, I think, the question.
Yeah. I'm still wondering about that myself. Obviously rooting for the gentle and easy, comfortable way myself, but we'll see how it goes.
I think it's going to take effort on people's parts. They're not going to be able to just sort of sit around and watch telly and order in pizzas quite as much as they do a lot of the time at the moment. If that's speaking for the people around me, obviously there are large parts of the world where that sort of thing is not possible.
Indeed. And I would think you're probably right. It is going to take some doing.
There are various attitudes. We can imagine that we will postpone this all and just have a big bloody apocalypse, and then that's how you know, the world ends. We can imagine all sorts of terrible events taking place, but equally we can imagine a world where we are able to intelligently and sensitively redesign ourselves and go into, you know, this really interesting phase of human culture where we end up with a genuinely global awareness of our position within the biosphere and the social relations that make that more likely to be sustainable rather than less likely to be sustainable. And as a magician, one of the things that I conjure for, that I work for, is having that possibility realized, because I have children, I have friends, I have colleagues, I love these people and care for these people and for the planet as a whole. And so I want to have a kind of nurturing future possibility. That doesn't preclude me being aware of the terrible things that happen on the planet or that have happened or indeed that may happen in the future. But it's to some extent, it's about my orientation towards the possibility of achieving things. And as a magician, I think that you have to have that essentially positive thinking.
I would agree completely. But I'm going to put on my conspiracy researcher hat for just a moment.
Go on, then.
And ask you to speculate about why does it seem, at least to some people, that those in power seemingly are on a mission to not only destroy nature, but humanity itself in many ways. We have things like bioengineered food. I think they call it geoengineering, where it's weather modification, all sorts of bizarre electromagnetic experimentation going on, extracting petroleum from the ground using techniques known as fracking that really seem to be turning the Earth into some sort of bizarre science experiment. Because this, I think, to me is where the sort of the rubber meets the road. We want to move towards a future where nature and humanity seem to be the same and working in concert and symbiotic. And yet right now, at least from some perspectives, it seems to be going in just the opposite direction.
I've obviously been talking about all this sort of stuff with a lot of friends and also my children. And one of the things that I've decided is that the reason that the world looks like it's being run by a bunch of idiots is that it is. So one of the things that's going on is that the people that are in power at the moment and that make a lot of these big scale decisions don't know what they're doing. So we then have to look at why are these people in charge? And it's because our system of choosing people to be in charge doesn't actually have any relation to their intelligence or their ability to care about things. So then you have to look at why do we have a system like that and why is it being able to be perpetuated? Why do we allow it to? So one of the things I've been thinking about for many years is about revolutions. I read a book about the French Revolution and how gory it was and how awful. And what seemed to happen is that these people overthrew the tyrants that were in charge of them. And then they just became even worse monsters than the people that they'd overthrown. The streets running with blood and all the horrible stuff. It's just nasty. Just the terror. It's just a bad part time to be alive, especially if you're living in Paris. So one of the things that needs to happen with a successful revolution is that you don't just get rid of the particular puppets, the figures that are the people that are there, because what you need to do is you need to change the system that is deciding who's in charge, for want of a better word. So one of the things that is happening in our current age is the fact that communication is so easy between large amounts of people. So you've got mobile phones, internet, people move around more, they talk more. Language is much more of a global thing. So a lot of people will speak English now, whereas if you go back even a few hundred years, people that live in one country and all spoke English wouldn't understand someone from a different area, even if they met face to face. So we have much better communication abilities, even on a linguistic level, let alone with all the technology that we have where we can film things, show them to each other on that perspective. So we have a system at the moment where people are elected, they have power, but rather than just destroying the people that are in charge of it and having the same thing then reappear, what needs to happen is that you need to have another system that's arising, which seems to be what's happening with the sort of cooperative type movements, networking type ideas that we're all familiar with, and a lot of us are part of different groups. And as those groups grow in numbers, the effect that they have on the world, the way that they exchange information, objects with each other, trading networks, they will invent their own types of ways of valuing different stuff. And so as those arise, the other system, it won't actually be necessary anymore. And in my opinion, we'll just disappear because we no longer have a need for it. I think in Switzerland, you're starting to see that already, where the idea of if you're changing a law there, you don't go to your MP and go and get them to go through parliament. You just get enough people together to sign a petition, and then it goes for the vote, and the people in the local area vote on whether they think that's a good or bad idea. And then it is or is not a law, for example, which is obviously, Switzerland is obviously a very separate nation to the rest of us, but that's the sort of the way that that sort of thing might emerge in the future.
So really, I guess it's about systems that will emerge to replace these things. And it may well be that there are, if you like, reactionary forces, and that there are lockdowns that happen by the dominant ideology in the face of those panics. And there are plenty of examples of that. So that's definitely a kind of a concern. But human beings are pretty resilient and resourceful things. And I like to believe that we may be a really very intelligent species, and that we can actually achieve some sort of sustainable, just, social set of situations on our planet. And these things will emerge. It's going to be very hard. We can't have like a top-down ideological approach with this kind of stuff. And whilst utopianism is sometimes a useful staging point, the idea of let's have a year zero, let's have some kind of an apocalypse, let's get rid of all of these terrible people, this terrible 1%, and let's kill them all and everything will be fine, misses the whole point.
Yeah,
definitely. I think one of the interesting things that's come up in economics and the finance world over the last 10 years or so is that rather than looking at the systems which are, like, we have the idea now that everything is top-down based, so there's the person that gives the law and they decide it, and then the body puts it into action. So rather than that top-down situation, which doesn't exist in any other form in nature that I've managed to find at all, is the idea of ecological networks as a model of financial and economic organisation. So there's been articles in the Financial Times, for example, about people using the way that plant systems and ecosystems function as a way of companies functioning, which is a far more tried and tested way of energy and money exchange as a metaphor than the idea of telling people how things work or gambling on stuff, because nature doesn't work that way. And nature itself has actually acted as a sort of experimentation proving ground for these different patterns and algorithms of how things interact and exchange substances, whether they're phosphorus or sugars or whatever it is that the different fungal systems and tree roots, for example, exchange with each other. So things like that are much more accurate, and they're a good example of resilience and sustainable systems that can then flourish in mutual symbiosis with each other, which in the long run, I think, is what most people would want. Like, if you're investing your money in something, you want it to succeed, but you also want other things around it to succeed as well, so that it can all flourish in an ideal universe anyway.
Oh, that's a fascinating idea, and something certainly worth considering, I think. I think this may be a reach from where we just were, but what are your thoughts about entheogens or plant substances that people have used since humanity began, I'm assuming, to alter their consciousness, and how do those sort of fit into this concept of Baphomet, or not, as the case may be?
Entheogens have been used since before people, by quite a long time.
Well, clearly it's important to give out the message that kids don't do drugs. However, it's also the case that entheogens and psychoactive chemicals form an important part of the human experience, and indeed the experience of, as Nikki alluded to, many other species as well, and our species before we were modern Homo sapiens. I think within the context of the magical tradition, they are a very interesting and I think quite sort of key part of lots of esoteric systems and cultures. And I think more broadly, going back to the political stuff, that one of the interesting things that I think Terence McKenna pointed out was that it's very interesting how psychedelics in particular are legislated against by both very left-wing and also very right-wing governments. And that's simply because they promote that the blurring of boundaries, and they promote the possibility of adopting new perspectives of the world. And from the point of view of a top-down ideology, those things are dangerous and must be stopped.
Now, on one level, I completely agree with what you just said. However, and I'm not trying to be argumentative about this, but my own research into this has led me to the conclusion very much that these same powers that be introduced and propagated the use of LSD in, at least in the United States during the 60s, and there's also some strong evidence to magic mushrooms or psilocybin is the exact same situation, that these things were sort of introduced initially as the way of mind control, and then when it was obvious that, that didn't work, that it was more of a way to create a sort of enlightened but sort of peon class that was more concerned with dropping out and turning on than it was with actual social change. And what are your thoughts about that?
I mean, that's a very good point, and I would certainly not suggest that these things are any kind of panacea. And it's definitely the case that, you know, there were guys from the CIA on Gordon Wasson's first investigations of psychedelic mushrooms and so on. LSD definitely has a significant role in terms of being used as a, or explored anyway as a chemical by the US and British military. These are powerful things. That's pretty much the end of the story. And so it's unsurprising that they're pressed into service by many different ideologies. I think, however, that if you look at things as long ago as the Good Friday experiment, you can equally see that these materials are, in the right set and setting, actually quite powerful, therapeutic, magical and mystical aids. And I agree that the position of drugs in our cultures in Britain and America and many other places in the world allows for addictions to emerge, allows for an underclass to develop, it encourages disconnection from, say, the political sphere or the social sphere. But that's because, I think, in large part to do with the context and the frame around these substances rather than the work of the substances themselves, and certainly isn't the total story of what they're capable of.
Well, I definitely enjoyed speaking with you very much, and I want to give you an opportunity, if you had any final thoughts for the people listening, or any message or anything that you wanted to get out, whether it's about the Book of Baphomet or anything else that you're working on.
Buy our book.
buy the books, please. Buy two. Buy one for best and to keep, because it will go up in value, and one to actually read. Have a look at the blog. We really, really like when people contribute and make comments and stuff. Just keep the conversation going.
Excellent. Well, Julian Vane and Nikki Weird, it's been a pleasure to speak with you.
Oh, thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Greg.
It's been very nice talking to you. Thank you.
Thank Great. You.
It's very been stimulating questions.
If you enjoyed this interview and haven't already, I once again recommend to you Julian Vane and Nikki Weird's excellent article, Baphomet Unveiled, which is freely available in the Occult of Personality membership section. Thanks again for listening to the show, and I hope you'll join us again next time.